Day 406, Saturday, May 11th, Ecclesiastes 5. Ecclesiastes 5:1-20 NKJV. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you on earth, therefore let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there is also vanity. But fear God. If you see the oppression of the poor, and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance, with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a severe evil, just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Daily Deep Dive, the UCG reading plan states, proceeding into the second section's last subsection, Ecclesiastes 5:1-17, Solomon now for the first time directly addresses his audience with several exhortations, starting in verses 1-7 with cautions about coming before God. As has been pointed to already, the answers to the problems of the human condition lie with him. But the creator and ruler of the universe must be treated with humble reverence and submission. The Tyndale Old Testament Commentaries volume on Ecclesiastes states, Earth's vanity has been recognized, Ecclesiastes 1:2-2:23, but, then, considered in the light of the life God gives, Ecclesiastes 2:24-26, and the assurance of his sovereignty, Ecclesiastes 3:1-13, injustice, Ecclesiastes 3:16-22, and various forms of isolation, Ecclesiastes 4:1-16, have been faced. We stand in need of an altogether greater companionship, the needed comforter. The preacher earlier told of a God who gives a life of joy and pleasure. May he be approached? This question is now answered in terms of the house of God, obedience, sacrifice, v. 1, prayer, v. 2f, vows, v. 4. But there are dangers. If God is in heaven, the ruler, Ecclesiastes 3:1-15, and judge, Ecclesiastes 3:16-22, he cannot be approached casually. So a proverbial unit is inserted dealing with our approach to God. Eaton, note on Ecclesiastes 5:1-7. It's noteworthy that, as commentator James Limburg points out, Ecclesiastes 5 is the place in the book where the most concentrated statements about God are found, with a total of 10 occurrences of the word, Encountering Ecclesiastes, a book for our time, 2006, p. 79. The phrase walk prudently, verse 1, is literally guard your feet, NKJV Study Bible, note on verse 1, that is, watch your step, and the context is that of going to the house of God. In Solomon's time that meant going to worship God at the temple. Today the house of God is the spiritual temple made up of his people, the church, Ephesians 2:19-22, 1 Timothy 3:15. The mention of God being in heaven, Ecclesiastes 5:2, could perhaps signify that God's heavenly abode is intended, so that the meaning could apply generally to coming before God anywhere, even in private prayer. Yet the fact that we are then told to draw near to hear, verse 1, would seem to indicate a place of instruction. Of course, people of that time typically did not have their own copies of the scriptures, so they had to go to where God's word was kept and proclaimed to be instructed. Today we still need to assemble to learn God's ways, but we can also receive instruction from the Bible in private study. Moreover, the Hebrew word shema means more than hear. It means to attentively listen and heed, and is often translated obey. Contrasted with hearing obediently is what we are not to do, give the sacrifice of fools, same verse. Note that what follows are warnings against being rash with the mouth and to let our words be few, verses 2-7. So the rash, multitudinous words are evidently the foolish sacrifice. Consider the opposite in Hosea 14:2, which encourages words of repentance, and offering the sacrifices, literally calves, of our lips, elsewhere referred to as the sacrifice of praise to God. That is, the fruit of our lips, which we are to continually be offering, Hebrews 13:15. The warning is not against lengthy prayers to God so much as it is about not being cautious and sincere in what we say, and failing to realize that we should not be making commitments we may not be able to fulfill. Solomon states, "For God is in heaven, and you on earth, therefore let your words be few," verse 2. The point is that God is the one in heaven with the supreme vantage point and control over earthly circumstances. We are not. The New American Commentary notes on verses 1-7. This text is similar to Deuteronomy 23:21-23, about keeping vows to God, but the emphasis in Ecclesiastes is on the limitations of human knowledge and the contingency of human existence. We should be careful about making great promises to God because we do not know if our circumstances tomorrow will be what they are today. We may not be able to fulfill the vows we make. Thus our promises before God would be shown to be no more than idle boasts, and we will fall under judgment. Garrett. We find similar warnings against swearing and making claims about what we will do tomorrow in the New Testament, with the point made that we can ensure things will happen as we profess, Matthew 5:33-37, James 4:13-16, James 5:12. Furthermore, Jesus told us to address God in prayer as our Father in heaven, Matthew 6:9, focusing on his sovereign position where he sits at the controls of the universe, as it were, and recognizing that we are far below him. We are not to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to, Romans 12:3. Expositor states regarding Ecclesiastes 5:1-2, in contrast to the power complexes of the previous chapter, we are brought quietly into the presence of God. Jesus may have had these verses in mind when he told the story of the two who went to the temple to pray. One a proud Pharisee who saw himself more righteous than others and one a tax collector who would not look up to heaven but prayed for mercy as a sinner, Luke 18:9-14. Here is a keen analysis of motives in prayer and worship. We come before God in humility, recognizing His majesty and His right to our lives. We seek His guidance and listen to His words, right? The preaching the word commentary notes, the creator/creature distinction has practical implications for what we say when we worship. We need to know our place, remembering both who God is and who we are. Isaiah said in one of his famous prophecies, which we quoted earlier in our comments on Ecclesiastes 3:11, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts." Isaiah 55:8-9, Ryken, p. 123. The statement in Ecclesiastes 5:3, "For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words," is apparently a proverb, and is paralleled by the statement in verse 7, "For in the multitude of dreams and many words there is also vanity." The meaning of both statements is debated. It should be acknowledged that an intensely busy schedule and dealing with many concerns may trigger more dreams while sleeping. Yet how does that parallel a fool's voice being known for many words in verse 3, many dreams and many words being linked together as vanity in verse 7? The New American Commentary maintains that the word dreams refers not to literal dreams, whether as revelation sought by sleeping in a holy place or as the disturbed sleep of one who has many anxieties. Instead, the word is used metaphorically, as in the English, "He has big dreams." Those who have many troubles may fantasize of performing great and noble acts, but their aspirations are meaningless, or amount to nothing. Similarly, many words, which proceed from the speaker's presumption that he is wise, mark a person a fool. See also 10:14. Verse 7a could be translated, "In excess dreaming there is an abundance of both vanities and words." In context, these proverbs mean that fools seek to advance themselves before God with great vows and promises. Note on verses 3-7. We should not be making rash and foolish vows before God, particularly in attempts to bribe or bargain with God, but verses 4-6 warn that if a person does vow, he should be sure to follow through. As David earlier wrote, "God will receive the person who keeps an oath even when it hurts, and does not change their mind." Psalm 15:4, NIV. The messenger in Ecclesiastes 5:6 before whom the one who vowed was not to say it was made in error was most likely a priest or other person sent from the temple to confirm or collect the vow. The trouble was that some people tried to get out of their commitments by coming up with all kinds of lame excuses. Vow? What vow? There must be some kind of mistake. PTW, p. 126. Of course, we'll all have to face the ultimate messenger of God, Jesus Christ, Romans 14:10. Thankfully, He and the Father are merciful. Once again, we can only cast ourselves on the mercy of God, pray that He will forgive us for everything we have failed to do, and ask Him to accept us through Jesus Christ. Jesus is the only one who ever kept all His promises to God, including His own vow to offer a holy sacrifice, the sacrifice of His body for our sins. P. 126. By God's mercy through Christ we are able to be forgiven for all our failures upon repentance and faith, and we now have help to keep our commitments to God and others. We are helped by a Savior who knows what it means to keep a commitment, who did everything He promised to the very death. P. 126. Instead of lofty imaginings about ourselves, we need to get real. For as Ecclesiastes 5:7 says, "The answer to vanity or frustration or fruitless or worthless life is to fear God, to be in humble awe and properly concerned to not incur His disappointment and judgment, deeply motivated to follow what He says," as we saw in 3:15, again, the very beginning of true wisdom. This is a preview of the conclusion of the whole book, bringing together its grand themes of vanity apart from God and the need to fear and obey Him. See Ecclesiastes 12:8, Ecclesiastes 12:13. Continuing in the last subsection of the second major section, Solomon turns next in chapter 5 to matters previously raised that might seem to call into question God's sovereignty and power, distracting from the healthy fear and reverence for God we must have. He starts in verse 8 with the issue of widespread injustice, earlier brought up in Ecclesiastes 3:16. The translation and point of Ecclesiastes 5:8-9 is highly disputed. One way to read verse 8 is as a corrective to systemic corruption, that everyone is answerable to someone higher up. Some, however, see the tiers of authority here as further oppression going up the chain. Others believe watches over here should be watches out for, meaning that government officials are protecting one another, thus preventing corruption from being rooted out. Verse 9, which may be a proverb, could be read to say that all the officials are unjustly taking from the land and its produce, all the way up to the king, as a summary of the corruption, leaving the matter unresolved. However, others render the verse to say that on the whole, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land, NASB. Some think this means a good king is an answer to the injustice in the previous verse. Others take this rendering to mean that government, even with its corruption, is better than anarchy. The New American Commentary states, "In an anarchic society no boundaries or property rights can be maintained, access to wells and other common resources cannot be fairly regulated, aqueducts and dikes will not be kept in good repair, and no organized resistance to ravaging armies can be offered. In short, the agricultural economy will collapse. Government may be evil, but it is a necessary evil." Garrett, note on verse 9. Indeed, God makes the necessity of human government plain in Romans 13. But this may not be the point of the passage here. Consider again that verse 8 of Ecclesiastes 5 could mean that there is always someone higher up in authority to deal with one practicing injustice. As one commentator notes, there is a chain of command and this means there is a chain of responsibility. In it we may have abusers of authority but they too are under authority and on up the chain of command, all the way up to the very throne room of God. Daniel Hill, Ecclesiastes, an Old Testament study, gracenotes.info, note on verse 8. This might well be the implication here, as others also believe. Dr. Walter Kaiser notes, "The highest judge of all is the one who will evaluate every judgment ever made," Ecclesiastes, Total Life, p. 76. While God is not directly mentioned here, it's possible that he is referred to by implication in verse 9, with everyone dependent on agricultural produce, produce that is from his hand, which he may withhold in judgment against corruption. Tommy Nelson writes, "The blessing of the Lord is for all. Even a king needs the blessing of God upon the field. A king is not sovereign. He looks to God to bless the land. These wicked men must deal with those above them who must deal ultimately with a sovereign God, a life well lived," p. 78. Kaiser states, "Ruler and people are happiest when they both realize that they are served by the farmed fields. But should human government also fail, there is still redress from God," p. 76. As one commentator translates the end of verse 9, "Even a king is subject to the soil," Robert Gordas, Koheleth, The Man and His World, 1968, p. 166. Of course, this may not require God's direct judgment. If a king is corrupt or allowing corruption, proper cultivation in agriculture and the other economic fundamentals in society will suffer, as will everyone, all the way up to the king. The consequences are thus automatic. Others maintain that a textual problem exists in verse 9 and have advocated reading the same Hebrew consonants minus the later vowel pointing with the words divided differently, Without changing the consonants of the Hebrew text, one may read, "The advantage of land is in its yield," that is, if the field is cultivated for its yield. Read this way, the verse thus makes the point that land ought not to be accumulated for its own sake but to be cultivated for what it produces, its yield, cl. So, the Anchor Bible, Ecclesiastes, 1997, p. 204. There is in this case no mention of a king, but this wording could still conceivably serve as a metaphor for society in that it needs the right kind of care to flourish, against the injustice mentioned in the previous verse. Yet the translation remains questionable, particularly as the verse can make sense without changing the vowel pointing and word division. Verses 10 to 17 give us some of the problems with wealth, starting with what may be a few proverbs. This passage could be here as part of the corrective for the corruption in verse 8, and possibly of verse 9 if that is referring to officials unjustly taking profit. Those who are all about padding their own pockets will end up with these problems of wealth accumulation. Of course, these problems exist even if the accumulation was not achieved unjustly, and it may be that these problems with wealth are here as a warning to those who respond to injustice in society by just trying to get what they can, focusing on self-reliance rather than relying on a God who continues to let bad things happen. But money is no substitute for God, and while it can be a help in life, it can also present serious burdens and difficulties. As part of the right approach and outlook, all of us should guard against setting the accumulation of wealth as life's goal, though we do need to strive to obtain adequate income in balance with meeting spiritual needs. In verse 10, the topic of an insatiable appetite is addressed, again, as we saw with the miser in Ecclesiastes 4:8. Desire always outruns possessions, no matter how vast acquisitions may grow, NKJV Study Bible, note on 5:10. However much one has, it is never enough. Thus, wealth is both addictive and unsatisfactory, NAC, note on verses 10 to 15. Another problem with having money is that people will take it, verse 11. As the Preaching the Word commentary notes, the phrase "they increase who eat them" refers in some sense to people who consume our wealth. It might be the oppressive government described in verses 8 to 9, which takes away our money through higher taxes. It might be our children or other dependents, the hungry mouths around our table. Or it might be the people who come begging for us to give them something, the spongers, the freeloaders, and the hangers-on. But no matter who they are, the more we have, the more other people try to get it. No one knew this better than King Solomon. He was the richest man in the world, but given the many thousands of people whom he had to feed, see 1 Kings 4:22-28, he almost needed to be. Ryken, p. 133. The Tyndale Old Testament commentary says, "Increased wealth brings increased taxation, in more than one sense. For riches have a knack of disappearing down a drain of increased responsibilities. An extended family will extend a bit further with each increment. The wage earner will see the goods but no more," Eaton, note on Ecclesiastes 5:11. Yet another drawback of riches is not being able to sleep at night, verse 12. Some translations specify the abundance here as the wealth itself, so that worrying over how to safeguard and maintain it is the cause of insomnia. Others, considering the mention of what a laboring man eats, specify the abundance of the wealthy here as that of a full stomach or gluttony, bringing indigestion and poor health, in contrast to the laboring man being able to quickly fall asleep no matter what he eats. Translations which maintain the ambiguity are best, Tyndale, note on verse 12. A further problem with money, Solomon calls it a severe evil or, as this may be rendered, a sickening calamity or terrible tragedy, is that it can do its owner harm, verse 13. A person who is not wise and careful in the use of wealth can suffer horribly, and we often see such stories about young Hollywood actors and musicians getting caught up in drugs and other wrong habits supported by their suddenly deep pockets. Indeed, Solomon himself was a premier example of one's wealth funding personal destruction. Despite his earthly wisdom, which no doubt gave him tremendous financial acumen, he allowed himself to pursue many vain and immoral ventures, which he would obviously not have been able to do to the degree he did if he had not been so wealthy. Nelson asks, have you ever considered that one of God's great mercies toward you is that he restricts the amount of money you make? P. 80. Compare with the prayer in Proverbs 37-9. It's also hurtful for a person with wealth to come to rely on it. For even if one is wise and proper in using money, it can still be lost. The word translated misfortune in verse 14 literally refers to a worthless task. Compare Ecclesiastes 3:10, NKJV Study Bible, note on Ecclesiastes 5:14. It might be a bad business venture or investment or a seemingly valid decision that proves catastrophic. The problem is compounded here with the mention of a man losing it all and then having a son and not being able to adequately provide for him or leave him an inheritance. The reality is that money can be here today, tomorrow, see Proverbs 23:4-5, for many reasons. Jesus warned against trusting in earthly treasure, which can decay, be consumed or destroyed, or stolen, Matthew 6:19-21. This is certainly no secure basis for happiness. Moreover, everyone parts with accumulated wealth at death. All of us are merely stewards of whatever material substance we have in our keeping, never truly owners in this life in an ultimate sense. The words of verse 15 recall those of Job, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord," Job 1:21. And Paul would later affirm, "For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out," 1 Timothy 6:7. As the expression goes, you can't take it with you. Or put another way, the more you have, the more you'll leave behind, PTW, P. 135. Solomon labels this another severe evil or terrible tragedy, Ecclesiastes 5:16. Nelson writes, "How much will a rich man leave? Everything. Every single dime." The only time in the Bible that God personally calls a man a fool is in Luke 12:19-20. "And I, a rich man, will say to my soul, Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared?" If you're a person who lives for accruing wealth, thinking that it will give you status, significance, and happiness, it will actually be a blessing if God halts your progress. P. 81. Such pursuit will only make for a wasted life, so that there is no profit or benefit, having labored for the wind, Ecclesiastes 5:16. Yet some still spend themselves for this empty goal. The darkness in which the miser eats, V. 17, is metaphorical for isolation and joylessness, Nack, note on Ecclesiastes 5:16-6. Eating would normally be done in fellowship with others, but not here, though eating could refer in a broader sense to living life, compare Amos 7:12, yet here alone. Tyndale notes on Ecclesiastes 5:17, preoccupation with wealth led to a gloomy life. Sickness points to the physical strain, vexation, or sorrow, indicates the cares and frustrations that tore at his mind and heart. Wrath, or anger, tells of the times he was enraged over thwarted ambitions and schemes. The miser will end up a bitter old man, for who has ever heard of a happy miser? PTW, P. 136. Here is another awful way wealth is kept to one's own hurt, as mentioned in verse 13. We find the remedy in what follows. At last verses 18 to 20 return us to the refrain of Ecclesiastes encouraging us to eat and drink and enjoy the good of one's labor as the gift of God. See Ecclesiastes 2:24, Ecclesiastes 3:12 to 13, Ecclesiastes 3:22. This being good and fitting or beautiful, as the conclusion to the book's second major section that began in Ecclesiastes 3:1. This section has been about pondering God's all-encompassing plan, the overall beautiful picture God is painting. We saw it presented with the times of life in Ecclesiastes 3:1-15. We saw problems of the human condition that can seem contrary to God's sovereignty over life in Ecclesiastes 3:16-4:16. And now in Ecclesiastes 5:1-17 we've seen cautions about proper approach and outlook, without which one will lose sight of God's overarching care and suffer worse problems. With the section conclusion we see the viable alternative to the problems thus far presented. The Tyndale Old Testament Commentaries volume on Ecclesiastes states regarding verse 18, there is another life, equally outward, real, observable. I have seen it, says the preacher. It is enjoyable in toil, not in its absence. It is a God-given provision in a brief life. To eat and drink is expressive of companionship, joy and satisfaction, including religious celebration, Deuteronomy 14:26. Here it is the symbol of a contented and happy life, eaten, note on verse 18. And verse 19 of Ecclesiastes 5 again informs us that not only what we enjoy, but the ability to enjoy it, comes from God. The Preaching the Word commentary puts it well. Some scholars find these verses so completely contrary to what the preacher has already said that they think he must be speaking sarcastically, or at least stoically, in pessimistically telling us to enjoy small pleasures, amid dreariness and soon coming death. But, when the preacher calls life the gift of God, he is giving it the highest praise. This is not stoicism or sarcasm but godly gratitude. The preacher can say this because he believes in the God of joy. Earlier in this passage, when he was talking about the vanity of money, the preacher hardly mentioned God at all. But in verses 18 to 20 he mentions him repeatedly. Whatever enjoyment he finds is God-centered. Without God, life is meaningless and miserable, especially if we are living for money. But when we know the God of joy, even money can be a blessing. To understand this, we need to pay attention to the phrasing of verse 19. Earlier the preacher listed some of the many reasons why accumulating money is vanity. Yet here he tells us explicitly that if we are wealthy, we should enjoy it. It almost sounds like a contradiction, but notice where the power of enjoyment comes from. It comes from God. Both having things and enjoying things are gifts from God, Ryken, pages 136-137. As pointed out before, some consider this call to enjoy material blessings as selfish. But it certainly is not. Expositors notes in its introduction to Ecclesiastes, interestingly, the book makes no suggestion of living a life of self-sacrifice, so as to spur the reader on to a life of philanthropy or self-deprivation. Koheleth would most likely identify self-sacrifice as meaningless if it is motivated by any degree of self-satisfaction. We need to remember that the author is not trying to describe the life of faith or what our faith responsibilities are, except that he will conclude by telling us to fear God and keep his commandments. Rather, he is contrasting a self-centered lifestyle with a God-centered one, in regard to how we ponder and respond to life's quandaries, right? By what the book does tell us, we can be assured that if we spent ourselves and all our resources in trying to help all humanity and right all the wrongs, we would still find that what is crooked cannot be made straight, Ecclesiastes 1:15. Compare Ecclesiastes 7:13. Indeed, We ourselves would then become a burden to others. Nevertheless, the book does encourage us to be good before God and to respond appropriately to life's circumstances. Obviously, this includes helping others in need, as we are in a position to reasonably do so. Some believe Ecclesiastes 11:1-2 refers to charitable giving, but while the verses could have application to that, they seem to more broadly concern diversification, as we'll see. Moreover, the commendation of the simple pleasures of life is not about the hedonistic pursuit already shown to fail. Neither is it about self-focus. Where the refrains speak of eating and drinking, it is clear that what Kohelet means by this is the time spent with family and friends around a common table. It is not the profound and expansive accomplishments of mankind that bring meaning and joy, but the unpretentious, everyday routine of eating together, sitting with family and friends to eat after a day's labor, laughing and enjoying the friendship around the table, finding a moment of cheer together, enjoying the companionship of one's spouse. These are the small yet profound moments in which we recognize an even greater truth. We were created for relationship, and it is in relationship with others and God that we find true meaning and joy. Tim Haig, Kohelet and Sukkot, TorahResource.com, 2001. Given the repeated exhortation to enjoyment in everyday life, it is astonishing that Ecclesiastes was a motivation for austere monasticism in the Roman Catholic faith. Martin Luther, father of the Protestant Reformation, wrote in the preface to his commentaries on Ecclesiastes of many of the saintly and illustrious theologians in the Church, who thought that, in Ecclesiastes, Solomon was teaching what they call the contempt of the world, that is, contempt of things that have been created and established by God. Among these is Saint Jerome, who by writing a commentary on this book urged Blessula, the daughter of a certain Paula who had already adopted Jerome's asceticism, to accept the monastic life. From this source there arose and spread over the entire church, like a flood, that theology of the religious orders of monasteries. It was taught that to be a Christian meant to forsake the household, the political order, to flee to the desert, to isolate oneself from human society, to live in stillness and silence, for it was impossible to serve God in the world, quoted by Limburg, Encountering Ecclesiastes, p. 18. As Luther rightly pointed out, the book actually teaches against this. God himself wants us to enjoy the ongoing blessings he gives us. He designed us to experience them, and they help us to endure life. Ecclesiastes 5:20 adds a new, remarkable concept for the person finding joy in everyday living. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. This recalls the poem of the times of life at the beginning of the section in chapter 3. Trying to gain a handle on it or make sense of it all is wearisome and futile though we all try. And one big point of contemplation here is recognition of one's own mortality. Yet the difficulties and brevity of life do not overly preoccupy the minds of those who find enjoyment in life through God. And in fact, Solomon right after the poem gave the prescription of enjoying everyday life along with properly fearing God in Ecclesiastes 3:1215. The Tyndale Commentary notes on Ecclesiastes 5:20, secular man may live a life of drudgery, but for the God-centered man it will be otherwise. Life will be so occupied with jubilation that the vanity of life will be well nigh forgotten. It is not entirely forgotten, however, for the word much, or unduly, implies that life's brevity will be kept in mind, cf. Psalm 90:12, but not so as to give the sleepless nights of Ecclesiastes 2:23. The Hebrew of keeps him occupied, or busy, with is linked with the term business that has occurred throughout Ecclesiastes. There is a business that vexes and frustrates, cf. Ecclesiastes 1:13, Ecclesiastes 4:8, the life given to man to live within a vain world with its kinks and gaps, cf. Ecclesiastes 1:15. The preacher repeats his remedy of a God-given life of faith and joy, which is even more preoccupying. Luther commented that Ecclesiastes 5:18-20 gives the clue to understanding the book as a whole. This statement is the interpreter of the entire book. Solomon intends to forbid, or help us to be rid of, vain anxieties, so that we may happily enjoy the things that are present and not care at all about the things that are in the future, lest we permit the present moment, our moment, to slip away, quoted by Limburg, p. 66. As Limburg summarizes, the book is a call to avoid anxiety, to embrace joy in the everyday present where we live, and to leave the future in God's hands. The teacher counsels living fully each day of one's life, one day at a time, enjoying God's gifts and enjoying one's work, p. 78. Christ also taught this principle of focusing on the present day in Matthew 6:34. And let us consider that ultimate fullness of joy and contented peace forever awaits those who live life in service to God through Christ, Psalm 16:11. Psalm 37:1-11, John 15:11, Acts 2:28. They will at last enter into the joy of their Lord, Matthew 25:21-23. Still, abundant, joyful living, John 10:10, need not, must not, wait until then. As Ecclesiastes repeatedly affirms, it is a gift for today as well. And,